Lindsey Graham steps into the abortion debate. Ron DeSantis sends migrants to Martha's Vineyard. And Europe contemplates a dark and cold winter. We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined, as always, by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, ExpressVPN, and the podcast What Happens. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So before we begin in earnest, I'd like to thank our sponsor today, NetChoice, which is a trade organization dedicated to free expression and free enterprise online. Being a parent is never easy, especially during the technology age. With more kids going online at younger ages, parents want to keep their kids safe and secure on the internet. To protect their kids, parents use services they trust, including the world-leading privacy and security measures, which are currently offered by tech services like app stores. But a new bill in Congress called the Open App Markets Act would disable many of these services by forcing companies to share their privacy and security features with third parties. If passed, the nonprofit Stop Child Predators warns that the Open App Markets Act will risk child safety online by breaking down these digital guard walls that protect children. It shouldn't be hard for parents to keep their kids safe online. Tell your senator, say no to the Open App Markets Act. So MBD, a lot of Republicans say no to Lindsey Graham this week. Graham, without sharing it with a lot of his colleagues, he was kind of worried if he sent the details around to every Republican office, they'd get leaked to the New York Times or the Washington Post, and there'd be hostile accounts even before he got started. But he worked closely with pro-life groups on a 15-week abortion ban. As it happened, he had his announcement event the same day we got the inflation report, 8.3%, and shockingly high. And the same day that Biden was celebrating the Inflation Reduction Act. So while Biden was stepping in it, a lot of Republicans think Lindsey Graham stepped in it further and made that day about something else rather than Biden's embarrassment. Of course, Lindsey Graham didn't know what the inflation number was going to be that day. But a lot of Republicans are just like, look, we want to talk about the economy. We've said this is a state issue repeatedly, literally for decades now. So what are you doing, Lindsey? So MBD, what is he doing?
I think he's trying to do a favor for the Republican Party. And we can debate about whether this is one or not. But for all the reasons you've said, this rollout did not go as well as it should have. I think he was right to be suspicious of sending it around to every other Senate office, although I wish he'd consulted maybe directly with other senators, because I think his instinct is correct that other Senate offices would have leaked it first or tried to move him off of the issue. But essentially, Republicans have been naked on the issue of abortion since Dobbs was overturned. They've failed to articulate what the Republican Party wants as a party now to be the standard going forward. And so they've allowed the Democratic Party to portray Republicans as extremists, as entirely tied to full-blown bans or those bans that are close to a full-blown ban. And this is a way of saying, nationally, here is an alternative we can get behind. It's a 15-week ban. I mean, it still allows, as Matt Iglesias was happy to point out, it still allows about 95% of abortions that would happen in the first 15 weeks or for health reasons afterwards. But I agree with Graham. I agree with Graham's politics on this, that Republicans can't have nothing on this issue while Democrats are making it a big issue in these midterms. Republicans have to say something. The problem I have, and I anticipate this is probably Charlie's problem too, is this: you cannot argue, as we have done, that, as we did for nearly five decades, that this is a state's issue, and then immediately go to the Senate with a bill like this. The U.S. Senate. This is something that national candidates and Senate candidates or House candidates can say they support in the states. They can say they support something like this happening in state legislatures, but doing it in the Senate and in the House, I think that muddies the message a bit, or at least it requires more explaining.
So, Maddie, I'm very much of the view that Republicans need to have a defensible compromise position on abortion. And I think 15 weeks is a pretty good spot. You look at the polling, you get up to 72% of people saying that abortion shouldn't be allowed after 15 weeks, including in one poll, I think it was a Harvard-Harris poll earlier this year, maybe in June, I think found that 70% of independents agree with that and 60% of Democrats. So this is a good place, I think, for the party to plant their flag, and is better than kind of mumbling and looking at your shoes. But instead of this being a consensus proposition in the Senate, everyone except for Graham has two co-sponsors, Rubio and Daines, I believe, but otherwise everyone's scattered and ran in the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, it is grotesque that we have this patchwork in the US where you can have one state will have a total ban on abortion, so no abortion whatsoever, and another will have abortion up till birth. And we all can picture what that looks like thanks to Lila Rose and those pictures from that DC clinic. It's really just barbaric. And I think what's interesting about the 15-week marker is it sets sort of alignment with how much of Europe feels about the abortion question, which is they've settled on this compromise. It's one that a lot of people feel they can live with. It's never going to satisfy pro-lifers. It is logically inconsistent, but as a political compromise, it can work. I think in defense of Graham, I suspect what he was probably doing was trying to use this standard, which again, you can point to Europe and say, look, lots of countries have reached this point. And have it in contrast to the Democrats' bill in Congress, which obviously is far more extreme, allowing for abortion up till birth in any circumstance. I think it's technically up till 23 weeks, but because health is so loosely defined, it really can be up till birth. But it's backfired in that the way that this is being reported is not as a 15-week ban, yeah, but as
a national ban.
A national ban, yeah. So certainly it has potential to backfire there. I'm sort of slightly undecided on the constitutional question. I'm not researched to defend the 14th Amendment argument, but certainly convincing people that I think are reliable seem to think it is plausible that fetal personhood is a valid concept and was at the time of the founding. I'd be interested in Charlie's thoughts on that. I know he has strong thoughts on that, but I'd just be interested in specifically why is this inconceivable, given that there was a greater respect for unborn life a few hundred years ago, than there is now.
All right, Charlie, Maddie has preempted me and asked you the constitutional question.
Well, the answer to that specific question is that there has never been at any point in American history any doubt whatsoever that the states are able to regulate and prohibit abortion. The Constitution, as written, was intended to leave the federal government as a limited partner with the states. And the Constitution accords only a handful of powers to that federal government and leads everything else to the states. So it's not a question of whether or not the founders and those who came after them after the Civil War were prepared to protect unborn life. It's a question of at what level that protection is sanctioned by the limited powers that the Constitution accords. And I think that to turn around having argued for 50 years correctly that the problem with Roe v. Wade was that it federalized a question that is nowhere mentioned in the Constitution, that it preempted the states at the federal level on the basis of mystical, inchoate, wishful thinking, and then to indulge that wishful thinking in the other direction is a profound mistake. Roe was nonsense. It was unmoored from the Constitution's text and history and original public meaning. We can't really argue, can we, that the original public meaning of the 14th Amendment was to protect unborn life, that the original public meaning and ongoing public meaning of citizenship has applied to the unborn, that this theory that actually, after all, amazingly enough, the 14th Amendment allows Congress to regulate and prohibit abortion is mainstream, has been built up, has been tested, has been accepted. Of course it hasn't. And so I don't look at this proposal and reject it on the merits. I look at this proposal and reject it structurally. Certainly, it cannot be justified under the Commerce Clause. I would assume everyone on the right agrees with that. Abortion or the prohibition of abortion are not commerce. They're not interstate in most cases either. And it cannot meaningfully be justified under the 14th Amendment. Andy McCarthy has a terrific post up now running through this in great detail. I also think, and this is both related to the constitutional argument and unrelated, that this is a political mistake. I think it would be entirely fair for Republicans as a party to say this is what we want to achieve in all 50 states. But I think the American public would be forgiven for regarding what Lindsey Graham just did as something of a bait and switch. I mean, again, forget the constitutional question. The rhetorical tone of the anti-Roe movement, which I've been a longtime member for a long, long, long time, has been that this is a question for the states. That's how it's been sold. And suddenly,
so, Charlie, so you've been consistent on this, but Republicans haven't. So they all supported a partial birth abortion ban at the federal level. They all in the Senate supported prior versions of Lindsey Graham legislation that would have banned abortion at 20 weeks. So for them, at least, it just seems quite hypocritical all of a sudden to say, oh, wait a minute, a federal ban? No, we're against that on principle. Now that it has real, could have real consequence and certainly has more political consequence than it did previously. And so just on the constitutional question, so if you believe an unborn child is a person, so that word does not apply just because the framers of the 14th Amendment wouldn't have thought about that possibility.
We have just fought a half century long war against substantive due process, the purpose of which is to read into the various provisions of the 14th Amendment license for judges to make decisions that were not and are not warranted by the original public meaning of the text. Now, I would love it if the original public meaning of persons applied to the unborn, but it doesn't. There's no indication that it does. There's no legal case that it does. There is no historical record of the authors or sponsors or debaters of the 14th Amendment proposing that it does. And I just do not think that we can retain our credibility. And as, again, Andy points out, adopt our own form of substantive due process that has the same structural effect, but different outcomes substantively.
So Charlie, Charlie, what was the legal status of the unborn then at the time of the framing?
Well, most states barred and punished abortion. And I'm not arguing they can't do that. Of course they can. The states have generalized police powers. They can ban marijuana. They can ban murder. But we don't have federal murder laws. You know, we separate out powers. It's not to endorse or indulge or tolerate murder to insist that our murder laws be set and enforced at the state level. It is to understand that this is what the state governments are there for. Now, of course, there are a few federal murder laws, but only when they relate to federal employees or something. And I think the same obtains here. We're not debating here whether or not it has been legal and widely popular to prohibit or regulate abortion. It has. That was the question in Roe and then in Dobbs. And progressives who have insisted that there has always been some constitutional problem with the regulation or prohibition of abortion are just wrong. This isn't that question. The question here is whether or not the federal government, constitution being a charter of enumerated powers, has the capacity to pass laws in this area, and whether or not the 14th Amendment or the Commerce Clause, which I hope we would reject out of hand, confers that power. And I think the obvious answer is no. There is nothing wrong, though, with Republicans at every state and local level in the country getting this done.
So what bothers me, I'm not saying I'm sure that I disagree with Andy McCarthy. I'm not sure I disagree with Andy McCarthy, but the 14th Amendment troubles me in this sense that it offers protections for life of persons. And if the 14th Amendment allows the federal government to intervene in Mississippi after three civil rights workers are killed, Michael Schwarmer, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, then it seems to me if we agree the 14th Amendment allows that, then it seems to me then you're obliging me to agree that persons cannot apply to unborn children. And I'm not willing to agree with that. I mean, maybe you'd have to argue.
Michael, we can play this the other way around very easily and say that if the federal government is allowed to intervene in Mississippi on behalf of persons whose civil rights have been violated, then the federal government is allowed to preempt our abortion laws, prevent any state from prohibiting or regulating abortion on the grounds that the persons in those states, the women in those states, are having their civil rights violated by the government if they're prevented from having abortions. And I think that's wrong. I also think that it's politically and morally wrong. But the issue here has to be what those words actually mean, not how they could be teased out filtered through our own political
preferences. Well, that is the debate ultimately we have to win. I mean, and I don't want to begin the debate by conceding I've already lost it.
No, but the argument that you just made, the example that you just gave, is obviously quite literally what the Civil Rights Act was intended to do. What we are talking about here is not. That's a really important difference. I mean, so the Civil Rights Act grew out of the Freedmen's Bureau Act and the civil rights legislation of the 1860s.
Right.
The 14th Amendment is essentially a constitutional codification of the 1866 Civil Rights Act. There is no doubt that the federal government believed that the Department of Justice, which was new, had the power accorded to it by the 14th Amendment to go into the states and uphold the civil rights of Americans who were being oppressed or murdered for their skin color. But there is no such evidence in favor of the proposition, and I don't like this fact, but it's a fact nevertheless, there is no such evidence when it comes to the unborn, which has historically been a question for the states, and at that point was governed by the states.
I definitely can see that, and I know that the authors of the 14th Amendment did not have the unborn top of mind, precisely because state laws were covering that. But if you are, I mean, you get into the difference between what their original intention was versus what the text obliges them. And I actually think the case about whether 19th century lawmakers considered unborn children persons is more complicated than Scalia had it in his opinion. I think there is some evidence that unborn children were considered persons. So that's all I'm saying is I'm not saying this is a slam dunk the other way, but I am saying it makes me very uncomfortable to surrender the position at the start that unborn children are persons. I mean, that's the whole point. The pro-life movement is fighting.
So Charlie, just a last thing on this, and then we got to move on. So I'm doing this debate on originalism tomorrow at the National Constitution Center. So I've been reading up on my originalism and having conversations with you and others about various controversy related to it. So would you, the original, you know, we should obviously discern the attempt to discern the original public meaning. But then after you do that, there is the question of application. So would it be in your mind, just theoretically impossible that, you know, a provision like the 14th Amendment is in the Constitution with language that clearly applies to a certain set of people that for whatever reason at the time, the framers did not consider people or had a, you know, morally retrograde view of or whatever, that subsequently people can discern and realize are persons that would require the original language would not apply to that set of people that are now considered persons. You'd have to pass a constitutional amendment or something of that nature.
I don't think that this is particularly difficult. And I am again with Andy McCarthy, who points out that the protections that are granted by the Privileges and Immunities Clause apply to citizens of the United States, and that meant and was codified at the time to mean people who were born or naturalized in the United States. And you can't shoehorn unborn Americans into that category, which leaves us with substantive due process, which is precisely the doctrine that led to Roe and that across the board we've been trying to rid ourselves of because it's so fluffy and overbroad and liable to be abused for, well, since Dred Scott, frankly, but more acutely since the 1950s and 60s when it started to be used to protect invisible rights to contraception or abortion or now gay marriage. I see the squinting, the sophistry that is on display here as being of a piece with that which led to Roe. And I want no part of it.
All right. So MBD, exit question to you. Lindsey Graham will, at the end of the day, have helped, hurt, or had no effect on the abortion debate prior to the midterms?
If the consequence, if the result is all Republicans running away from him and shutting their ears and their mouths, then this will have hurt because it will just feed into this media narrative that there's a national ban about and Republicans will have failed to take the opportunity to clarify what they believe about life.
Maddie Kearns.
I don't think it's going to have an effect either way.
Charlie.
Well, I don't think the effect will be profound. I do think Michael's right. I think that Republicans should have perhaps been less horrified in their tone, should have been calmer in their reaction and said, well, yeah, and
they're,
we don't.
They're in effect defining a 15-week ban as some sort of radical
right
measure.
And it's not, but the answer should have been, we think this is an issue for the states. 15 weeks is what Florida's done. We'd like to see this or better everywhere. Instead, they said, oh my goodness. And they made Lindsey Graham's proposal look as if it were toxic. So I do think it will hurt a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. It hurts very marginally. I put it more on, I put it entirely on other Republicans though, but not on Lindsey. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor of this episode, ExpressVPN. Charlie, over to you.
ExpressVPN, which incidentally I am connected through right now because I am in a hotel room and you never know who's watching you in hotel rooms. But there are other applications for VPNs, and one of them is making sure that large corporations, especially streaming services, do not spy on you. You know what's not fair? The fact that Netflix hides thousands of shows and movies from you based on your location, and then has the nerve to increase their prices on you. That's right, they've just raised their prices once again. Now, you could just cancel your subscription in protest, or you could be smart about it and make sure you're getting your full money's worth by using ExpressVPN like I do. So you might not know that what's on Netflix in your country is completely different from what someone in, say, the UK or Japan has on theirs. But using ExpressVPN, I can control which country I want Netflix to think I'm in. ExpressVPN has over 90 countries to choose from, so every time I run out of stuff to watch, I just switch to another country to unlock new shows. And here's the best part. It's not just for Netflix. You can use ExpressVPN to unlock shows on other streaming services too. Now, personally, I like to use it to watch BBC iPlayer, which is a free service that's only available in the UK. My dad's always asking me if I've seen this or that on iPlayer. Well, I can't watch it in the US, but I can watch it in the US if I pretend that I'm in the UK. ExpressVPN is also super fast, works on your phone, your laptop, even works on smart TVs. So you can watch your shows on the big screen with zero buffering. So stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/editors. And don't forget to use our link so you get 3 extra months of ExpressVPN free. That's ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/editors, ExpressVPN.com/editors.
Thanks so much, Charlie. So, Maddie, I know in your long winding path to become a legal resident in the United States, you were waiting at some point for someone to fly you to Martha's Vineyard and just leave you off there. It never happened for you. It did happen for about 50 Venezuelan and Colombian migrants. Obviously, I'm making light of it, much different circumstances. We talked earlier in the week about these busing operations that Governor Abbott has undertaken to send illegal migrants to blue sanctuary cities. This is Ron DeSantis, still a little murky in some of these stories, you know, whether it was just one plane from Florida and there were 2 planes total, maybe one emanating from San Antonio and making various stops before it got to Martha's Vineyard. So we don't know the every single detail of the story, but given what we know, what do you make of it?
Yeah, so the Abbott stuff of putting people on buses and sending them to these sanctuary states, I kind of could understand, get behind. These are the people who've said that they'll welcome migrants with open arms, even though we know that's largely disingenuous. They should be the ones to put them up. And so that made a certain amount of sense. Of course, it didn't actually necessarily always work out that way because people would get off it in red states because red states are actually have a lower cost of living and are more attractive in many ways. So it wasn't working out perfectly, but it was making a point. And I don't think any serious harm was being done to the migrants. I'm really uncomfortable with this move by Ron DeSantis. I think there is one thing to be cruel, to be kind. There's another thing just to be cruel. I think that is the point here. You know, having been sort of down on my luck as an immigrant and very much dependent on the kindness of other people, when you're in that vulnerable state, you just, anybody offers you help and it means a lot to you and you take it. And you might not necessarily understand what you're signing up for. I think a lot of these people won't really understand what Martha's Vineyard is, won't really understand that it's not a great place to be stranded. It doesn't have that much capacity. And of course, it being in a plane, you can't just stop off somewhere along the way. I understand the point that these are people who have entered the United States illegally, and that's wrong, and they shouldn't have done that, and it shouldn't be made so easy to do that. However, two wrongs don't make a right, and they are still human beings and they still have dignity. And it's not, I don't think it's funny to sort of take advantage of somebody who is very vulnerable. And I think that these people are. And so I disapprove of this policy.
So Maddie, when you say cruel, be kind, you mean if we have a policy at the border, we're turning around, no, you can't come,
yes,
because ultimately we don't want people to make the trek and it's bad for our interests and all that. But you see this as a different phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, so, like the disingenuous of the Democrats in incentivizing people to do this is shameful. It should be big walls and big doors. If you want to come to this country, you must line up in an orderly fashion. You must apply. You must go through all this stuff. It should just be zero tolerance for people at the border. You know, we should send people back. You can't come here illegally. You have to do it by the law. But if you're going to bring people in and then just sort of use them as pawns to prove a point and send them around the country, without any regard for the fact that, as I say, they're human beings in a difficult set of circumstances. And they're not, you know, it's easy to sort of see it as, well, they shouldn't have done this, so therefore I have no sympathy. I understand that, but, you know, these are people who a lot of the time had the misfortune of being born in some dump. We're very lucky that wasn't us. And you know, of course, like a country you can't take the weight of the world on your shoulders. No politician can do that. No country can do that. But I think somebody who does something wrong because they want a better life for their kids is not quite the same in my book as somebody who does something wrong just because they're, you know, some other reason, some selfishness or just vice or whatever. I mean, it's like somebody stealing a loaf of bread to feed their family. It's still wrong, but you kind of understand how people get themselves in these situations. So maybe that makes me a big bleeding heart liberal. I don't know, but I certainly I'm not comfortable with treating them like this.
So Charlie, there's certainly a lot of people on Twitter who would consider Maddie a bleeding heart liberal. The position she just outlined, the reaction, a lot of folks on the right was, yes, you know, this is awesome. This is based. We need more of this kind of in your face. Might be the first use of based on this podcast. I don't know, MBD, have you used it before?
I'm sure we've used it before.
this is a based action. We need more of this kind of in your face action against self-righteous progressives.
Well, I think that this is a sign of desperation on the part of many people who are tired of seeing what Maddie described as the incentivization of illegal immigration, the costs and downsides of which do not fall equally. It's not, you know, politics as I would like to see it exercised, but I do understand where this is coming from, and I think that it has been rather effective. And as I said on the podcast the last time we talked about this, we are now hearing from the people who are responsible or indulgent of and for our tolerance of illegal immigration, all of the arguments that have fallen on deaf ears when coming from, say, poor Texan border towns for years. And in some cases, ridiculously so. Now, there are some towns in Texas that have 30,000 people in them, and they get 10,000 illegal immigrants. But we have 7,000 of them in New York City, and suddenly there's a budgetary crisis. And I don't know how else Greg Abbott, and to a much lesser extent DeSantis, Florida being differently located geographically, are supposed to get this across without resorting to these games. Now, if anything here is illegal, I will, of course, have a much greater issue with it. But I think this is a sign of desperation. I occasionally wonder whether the political journalist class thinks that everything that happens in the United States is a video game, is an abstraction. You know, there are people who will tweet whenever the question of illegal immigration or a new caravan or a mass crossing comes up, that this has been pushed into the news to distract from something. Oh, Biden's approval rating going up a bit. Let's talk about the border. This is not true. This stuff gets talked about because it's happening and because it has a real effect on people. So I'm more tolerant of it. I must say, I think this is one of those issues where the populists are absolutely at the end of their tether with an elite class that is out of kilter with where the majority of Americans are and has views on this that are preposterous. Sure, I can find fault with the specifics, but just the scale of the response has demonstrated the point. This is a problem, and it's a problem that shouldn't be ignored just because it happens down into from the view of Los Angeles or New York or Chicago, the flyover country.
So MBD, where I kind of draw the line is it are the migrants signing up for it? And if they want to go to Chicago, and you're Greg Abbott, and you want to make a point about this and make sure that this crisis is being felt nationally, nothing wrong with it. This is just, it's unclear the migrants really knew where they were going. Also, you know, it's good to give a heads up, I think. You know, be sure you have your shelter ready. 50 migrants are on the way rather than just kind of having them show up at the airport unannounced. But ultimately, you know, this is a Biden administration failure. It is one that they courted pretty much deliberately. I mean, they ripped up everything that had worked, that Trump had implemented near the end. And now they have the temerity to say, oh gosh, you know, we're doing so much more than Trump, because all Trump tried to do was build a wall and didn't succeed in building a wall, ignoring, you know, the migrant protocols and the stay in Mexico policy. And you know, the pandemic diminished the flows to a great extent. And the Trump administration was helped by Title 42, which Biden has been leaning on as well to keep this from turning into a total tsunami. But they created the crisis, and they won't acknowledge the crisis, and they won't do anything to stop it. And they just want the border states to absorb the pain.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I agree with you and with Maddie on how important it is that the people agreeing to this have some knowledge of what they're getting into, right? But the policy of busing to Chicago, Washington, D.C., and New York, sanctuary cities, people who agree to it is, I think it is a perfect bit of consciousness raising. In fact, it is a it demonstrates that in fact the political rhetoric around sanctuary cities acts as a magnet for illegal migration into the border states and creates the humanitarian crisis we now have at our border, the humanitarian crisis we have throughout Mexico, and even contributed to, you know, further political instability in Central America, where the fact of America being used as a release valve encouraged more political extremism and violence. So I think it is important to demonstrate that, in fact, Martha's Vineyard and New York City have a stake at the border. And like on a certain level, it's also, it's also funny. Maybe some of these migrants didn't know what they were getting into, but in fact, Martha's Vineyard actually is a nicer place to see than a San Antonio shelter, in many respects, especially this time of year. And this crisis has to be made real toward people who help create it. And if this dramatization gets us to the day closer when we can finally sensibly agree on tough border enforcement in order to discourage human trafficking and discourage dangerous venturing, that is to be welcomed.
So Charlie Cook, exit question to you. Sometime before the end of his first term, Joe Biden will feel compelled to implement strong, sensible measures at the border that will demonstrably reduce the flow of illegal immigrants into this country. Yes or no?
No. It's a choice. If he doesn't understand now why this is a problem, I don't see why he would change his mind. But I do think that over time, this is going to alter the politics around this question and forge more of a consensus across the country.
MBD?
I mean, they want to get rid of Title 42. I mean, they say they want to make it worse, but I do think that this issue hurts them so much that they're going to have to... I think Biden will switch into Obama mode of trying to find some way of saying I'm increasing deportations to record levels, whether mm-hmm. that's a fudge or not.
All right, so that, Charlie's a no. MBD is at least a fake yes.
A fake yes.
Yeah, I mean, the status quo is obviously unsustainable. I'm inclined to agree with what Michael said. I think that he'll have to at least give an indication of doing something. Whether that means he's actually doing something is something quite different.
I don't know. I think the first year or so, if I'd asked this question, I would say, yes, of course they're going to have to do something. It is going to be politically unsustainable. I'm not even sure they're going to have to do a fake yes. I'm with Charlie. No, I mean, they just seem determined on this and mostly can get away with it. It's not as though the press, besides, you know, Steve Ducey, is calling them on it, calling them out on it with any regularity. So I'm going no with
Rich, they'll stop doing it when the opinion polls come back and show a majority of Hispanics are voting Republican. That's when they'll change their policy. Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
So join head fund manager Larry Bernstein for his podcast, What Happens Next in 6 Minutes. I realized, by the way, the tease at the top of the show, I left off half of the title of this podcast. My apologies. It's not what happens, it's what happens next in 6 minutes. The format gives the guest speaker just 6 minutes to present his argument, followed by a provocative question and answer period for deeper engagement. Check out the What Happens Next in 6 Minutes podcast with Matt Continetti, our friend, on the history of the American right and why there's never been a consensus among conservatives, Aaron Friedberg and how we screwed things up with China, Casey Mulgan on what is driving inflation up, Tom Sankton on the challenges in obtaining a ransom for a business executive after a kidnapping, What Happens Next in 6 minutes is fast-paced, intense, and thought-provoking. Bring your A game because What Happens Next will challenge you. New episodes are posted every weekend. What Happens Next in 6 minutes can be found on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe and give the show a listen. So we want to talk next about the European energy crisis, but I would be remiss if I didn't note that Maddie was over in the UK to follow the Tory leadership election and the ascension of Liz Truss, and was there for the passing of Queen Elizabeth II. It's been on our TV screens here, at least in the background, for days now. Incredible ceremony at Westminster Abbey yesterday. I just had to pause and watch. You know, it just went to the incredible power of that institution, the monarchy, the incredible power of tradition, and it just spoke to the kind of seriousness and the depth of the British nation. But Maddie, before we get to grubby energy concerns, What are your impressions of what's been going on in the UK?
So I was in Westminster. They are thinking I was reporting on a new prime minister, and quickly it became clear that there was going to be a new monarch. So I think it was a Thursday, September 8th, and they said the Queen's health had taken a bad turn. And everything from Buckingham Palace, every statement, especially of this nature, is always really, really understated. So it said she was, her doctors were concerned and she was under medical supervision, which basically everyone reading between the lines just knew she was dying, especially her family then rushing to her bedside. And so I, on instinct, decided to go down to Buckingham Palace and sort of wait outside. And it was really strange because there was just a lot of people in the similar position, just sort of waiting around, waiting for something to happen, which is kind of gloomy. But in any case, eventually the news broke around, it was like 6:30 local time, I think, and they put the flag down. And then this crowd of hundreds became crowds of like thousands. And it was very, very surreal. There was one family outside. It was a grandmother, a father, and a son. And they were saying it was so strange because this had been the Queen had been a permanent fixture of all three of their lives. And it was kind of this link to the past, and her being gone was very surreal and destabilizing. And I actually think I've been kind of touched seeing the tributes and seeing how long people are waiting to queue to pay their last respects. Just not because I'm a monarchist or anything like that, but just because it's so easy with woke culture and everything, just to assume that everybody hates the past, everyone has no association to it. There's no respect for tradition, and this just sort of flies in the face of that. And I think it's a moving tribute to Britain's past.
Absolutely. So MBD, let's get to energy, which is a big deal. A lot of people have been warning about the winter. We're already seeing the turmoil in the markets. Just a forecast of things to come. What do you make of it?
I am shocked. I mean, President Emmanuel Macron of France gave a speech in which he said that the end of abundance was upon France and that freedom has a cost. And you're seeing similarly dire and dramatic statements coming out of Italy. You're seeing people stocking up on firewood in Germany. I've seen pictures out of Ireland of people illegally selling turf for putting in your stoves for turf fires and marketing it as Irish mud, not for burning, which gives you a little bit of an attitude toward law.
What is turf?
It's literally like dirt and mud out of the bogs, and you can burn it for heat.
Because there's a little fuel in there?
Peat and other energy.
Mm-hmm. It's also a delicacy in Ireland. I think that's served in the restaurant.
Stop. No, but I mean, it's true. I mean, you could, you used to be able to buy AGA furnaces that took turf as fuel. This is shocking, it is going to be a huge test of Europe's ability to pivot very quickly to liquefied natural gas and other sources of energy as they prepare for Russia to completely close them off as we head into the winter. And it'll be a test of Europe's political mettle. You know, are they willing to... if the United States and Britain are giving a lot of money and weapons to Ukraine, this is the sacrifice that is being demanded of France and Italy, Germany, and a number of other European nations, and whether they are willing to keep up with this political sacrifice. And I think it's a very high stakes one. I mean, are you ultimately, what is more important to you, the security pact with the United States or the energy pact with Russia? And, you know, like if you had to choose between heat in the winter or your gun in the safe, That's a mighty desperate choice to be forced to make. So, you know, I hope that Europe gets through it, and the United States can help get through it, help them get through it. But I mean, the even Biden administration has indicated some potential export controls on oil and energy to Europe. So I really wonder how much solidarity is here when everyone's
during the pandemic, right, with PPE and other things. You take care of your people first.
How committed are you to
alliance or good global citizenship, quote unquote.
Well, of course, and that's actually, thank God, because we still have a semblance of democracy in all these nations, because I think without it there would be no accountability toward the people themselves. So I don't know. I'm just watching as a very interested person, and with family in Europe, I'm very concerned. But I think in general, I do think Europe's spine has been stiffened, at least among the leadership, because they don't like the bullying from Russia.
Yeah. So Charlie, first of all, they should have been much smarter from the outset and minimized their vulnerability to this, which they didn't, you know, with Germany leading the way. And then as it became clear what they'd potentially be facing, there should have been an immediate, you know, all of the above policy from everyone. And you've seen some signs now of, you know, desperation born jettisoning of the piety is about climate change. You know, Germany is burning all the coal possibly can get its hands on. Liz Truss now says we're all of the above people, but that's not going to make a huge difference in the months to come here.
You know, there's a famous line from Gandhi at the expense of my country of birth. He was asked what he thought of British civilization, and he said he thought it would be a good idea. And that's how I feel about European energy policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a misnomer. They haven't had one. They have leaned on their status quo. They have ignored the warnings. And they have tried to move towards this Greta Thunberg model without leaving much headroom for crises, whether those be economic or international, as we've seen with the Russian invasion and occupation of Ukraine. There has been no strategy, no joined up thinking. The French are an exception to this rule because 60, 70 years ago, they decided they were going to build a whole bunch of nuclear power stations. And they did it, and it works. But we haven't seen that approach in Britain, Germany, elsewhere in Europe. It is astonishing to me that Liz Truss came in and had to say, okay, we're not banning fracking anymore. Why? Because the British were put in such a difficult position that luxury became untenable. That's not a strategic move. That's a desperate move. That's a panic move. That's the sort of move we talked about in California. You don't want to be in that position. If fracking is such a problem, and I don't believe that it is, but if fracking is such a problem that the British government looks down on it and wishes to reject the gift that it's been given, then something else has to take its place. You can't just remove it. Make all of these nice sounding arguments for why it would be immoral to frack. Have the Church of England weigh in, explain why God would dislike fracking. And then when it comes to it, say, oops, I guess we need to do that after all. So, I mean, I look at Europe as a complacent sort of continent. I don't think, unfortunately, we lack all of those instincts ourselves in the United States. I mean, we're divided. We have two parties that disagree profoundly on this, but we also have regional differences. You know, in some states, it really is drill, baby, drill, all of the above. And in other states, we see a more European approach to traditional fuel sources. But I think, you know, broadly speaking, Europe needs to sit down and work out what it wants to do. What does it want to do militarily? What does it want to do in its energy production? And have a plan rather than behave like a pinball, you know, bouncing around, hit Greta Thunberg at one point, change course, watch the Russian invasion of Ukraine at another, change course, have a particularly bad winter, change course, pinging and ponging around, making decisions on the fly. This is really a backbone question. Energy, you can't have a modern economy without energy. And it's amazing to me how blasé these rich and supposedly sophisticated nations have been.
Maddie?
Yeah, so when I was on Charlie's question about what do you do next, like obviously they've got themselves into this mess, but what sort of policy are they going to come up with? It was interesting, when I was in London, the first Prime Minister's questions was all about this. Liz Truss suggested this energy cap. She's got cap prices for the consumers. I think it's like £2,500 or something. But the difficulty with that is she's just adding to the national debt. That causes more burden on the taxpayer further down the line. The Labour Party know that. Of course, their solution is just to tax energy companies, which just deters investment. So can't really do that either. This also flies against Truss's supposed free market principles that politicians are setting prices. That's obviously not very Thatcher-esque. So she's got herself into this bind and is taking a big political gamble. And I think you're seeing similar desperation in other European politicians, and it will likely continue.
Excellent question. Do you, MBD, the European Alliance Against Putin, will survive the winter, yes or no?
No.
That's
no.
That's a pregnant.
I just don't think
sighs.
No, I just don't
sigh
think
so. And a pause.
I'll just say why quickly. I worry that we've created this where, in a sense, you know, Europe was put at the child's table by the Soviet Union and the United States at the end of World War II, and we've never really let them up from it. We said, we'll protect you, and mostly at our cost, and you will be able to have your middle-class lifestyle again as long as you don't have defense, but you won't really have foreign policy independence. Well, now they're under threat of losing that middle-class comfort too, and I think that is going to really, really raise the stakes. And Europe's electoral politics are really convulsive right now already.
Charlie Cook?
No, I don't think it will survive the winter. I do hope, though, that it will
lead. So what does that look like?
Well, I don't mean literally they won't survive the winter. I expect to hear from them next year. But well, I don't think that the sanctions and policies that they've put in place will be sustained, or if they are sustained, they'll be only partially so. What does it look like? Buying Russian oil.
Or there's another alternative is that we completely bail them out, which I would say is not them holding up their end of the bargain, but taking an entirely new one, which is costly to us.
Maddie Kearns.
I think it will survive, but will be severely strained.
And with Maddie, I think just everyone's too committed at this point. Also, the Ukrainian gains, assuming they hold, make it harder to bail out. But it's going to be a horrible winter, and there will be a lot of political turmoil, obviously, around this. With that, let me do a quick NR Plus plug. Digital subscription service at nationalview.com. Your way around our paywall. And if you sign up and log in, your way to see 90% fewer ads at nationalreview.com. We know those ads can be obnoxious and distracting, but if you sign up for NR Plus, we don't need to make advertising money off of your visits and page views, so you don't see the ads. And if you want to dig deeper into our community, you can comment on articles and blog posts. You can be part of our private Facebook group if you want to, and you can be part of all sorts of exclusive calls and events. Charlie and MBD and I did an informal NR Plus Zoom call, like 80 people a week or so ago, just shooting the breeze, talking about politics. We have a meetup coming up out in LA. You'll learn more about that in due course if you're an NR Plus member in the area. And finally, just signing up is just a crucial way to support our very, very valuable journalism. So I urge you, for all these reasons and even more, I got more reasons, but we're limited on time here. Please, please, please sign up for NR Plus. If you haven't already, you won't regret it. So let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you've been listening to the Pogues.
Yeah, the Pogues, If I Should Fall from Grace with God, just a classic album from the 80s. And the track Thousands Are Sailing is really one of the most beautifully compact pieces of poetry put to music in the last 40 years. And I just can't believe how much talent came out of Shane McGowan, despite himself drowning himself in so many Long Island iced teas.
Mm-hmm. And Maddie, you went to New York City Comedy Show.
Yeah, it's the Comedy Cellar down in Greenwich Village, and took my brother there. He was visiting, and I was a bit nervous about it because it was a new joke night, which is where comedians come on and try out material and figure out whether or not it's worth keeping as part of their larger shows. But it was quite cool because a couple of big names stopped by. So there was Louis C.K. and Hasan Minhaj as well. So some of their jokes were very funny. Some of them weren't, but that was also quite funny because they were literally with their notes and they would say, okay, guess not that one, scrunch it up and throw it away, which is amusing as well. But really recommend doing that if you're ever in New York.
Charlie Cook?
What did I say I was going to do?
You said you were going to talk about your informal NR meetup in DC.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. Well, we had an informal NR meetup in DC.
I know more about your life than you do, Charlie.
I've forgotten it already. I didn't have that much to drink.
Yeah, it must have been a compelling night.
It was. It was a compelling night. Many drinks were consumed. Not enough for me to not remember it. Yeah, I'm in DC. I'm emceeing the CEI dinner tonight. And so last night, I asked everyone in the area if they wanted to meet up. We met up at the Dubliner, which is actually next bridge to Kelly's Irish Times. I hadn't realized this when I got there.
Yeah, right next door. And you're either an Irish Times guy or a Dubliner guy. I've traditionally been very much an Irish Times guy.
Well, funnily enough, last time I was at Kelly's Irish Times was for an NR event, and Lindsey Graham was sitting at the bar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, about to head out to a Hannity hit.
Yeah. So, anyway, we didn't go to Kelly's Irish Times. I went to the Dubliner.
You should have told him a thing or two about the 14th Amendment, Charlie.
I know. I should have called it. I'm sure he loves that. Anyhow, it was a splendid time was had by all. I like both places, I must say. Food was pretty good at the Dubliner, and so was the conversation. And it was, in fact, memorable. I'd just forgotten what I was going to talk about, not the event itself.
So I've been following, of course, with great interest, Aaron Judge's historic offensive season. You look at the offensive stats, and it's pretty much Aaron Judge everything except for stolen bases and average, but he's creeping up an average. It's not inconceivable, probably less likely, less than 50% chance, but it's not inconceivable he could win the Triple Crown. And of course, he's creeping up on Roger Maris, the true home run record, that even if you don't believe that, the American League record, and just as importantly, the New York Yankees record, has 57 home runs. I'm not like Charlie. I can't afford to be at a bar every night watching the entirety of the Yankee game that night, all 3 hours of it. So I'm usually following it on the ESPN Gamecast on my phone. And last night I was doing this as I was trying to finish a column at like 11, you know, well, 10 o'clock at night or whatever it was. And then I get up and, you know, walk into the family room, and Mike's like, where are you going? I was like, Aaron Judge is about to come up. So you literally have to watch, if you're a fan, every single one of these at bats. Didn't hit a home run last night, but I think one for three, maybe one for four, but it's just an incredibly compelling performance by a classic Yankee, kind of class act, very professional, kind of keeps it buttoned up, sort of Joe DiMaggio-esque kind of lack of emotion on the field, bad calls. You know, he never argues. He might smile. He might smile derisively when he gets these low balls called strikes, because the umpires can't account for the fact that he's incredibly tall, which is something that will go away when we get the robot strike zones that we deserve. But anyway, it's been incredible to watch. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is Dan McLaughlin's piece on the shape-shifting Evan McMullen, the Utah Senate candidate and former presidential nominee for Never Trumpers. It's kind of had a shifting set of positions over the years, and Dan McLaughlin neatly traces them out. So check it out.
Maddie Kearns.
My pick is just the general work of Dominic Pignol. I think
that was exactly what I was going to say.
Wow.
He does a really, really great job explaining the complex ins and outs of economic policy, especially to people who that's not their main thing. I'm speaking about myself, obviously. So in particular, he had a really great piece on the potential train strike, which was very helpful. So
yeah, we were going to talk about the impending train strike, but it didn't happen. So we scratched it off the topics. But if it had indeed been a topic, it just would have been straight cribbing from Dominic Pignol, from maybe everyone on this show. Charlie.
Well, I'm going to choose Andy's dissent from the editorial, which I've referenced three or four times, which is comprehensive, a one-stop shop for anyone who thinks that the Constitution requires the abortion debate to be resolved at the state level.
I'm going to preemptively choose Ramesh's response to Andy and Charlie on the 14th Amendment. Now, I go Dominic Pignol as well. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or count of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Maybe better than you deserve. Better than you deserve to listen to. That's that good. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to NetChoice, ExpressVPN, and What Happens Next. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.